This is $50. Yeah. It's right now.
The House Transportation Committee will come to order and welcome everybody. We're going to go ahead while we're waiting. We're having a bit of a slow start today, I guess. And open a continuation of the public hearing on House Bill 2042. And Patrick, you want to just remind us again?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2042 is, we heard on Monday, that's the bill that stipulates the right and privilege to construct, maintain, and operate utility lines, fixtures, and facilities along public roads free of charge, does not extend to public roads under county jurisdiction.
Thank you. Should I do this in the coming back? Okay. I'm going to ask Darren Lane to come forward.
I'll have to double check, but I think it's okay in all these cases.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you like me to state my address or anything like that, or do you?
Your name.
Okay.
Yeah.
My name is Darren Lane. I'm the director of the Linn County Road Department, Linn County, Oregon. Chair Beyer and members of the Transportation Committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be here to talk about House Bill 2042 and to express my support. I represent the Linn County Road Department in Linn County, Oregon. My department is responsible for over 1,100 miles of road and over 325 bridge structures. Utilities in the road right-of-way are a fact of life for us. We accept that and we understand that. Road right-of-way is a logical conduit for public and some private utilities. They provide valuable and necessary services to nearly all of our citizenry. In fact, many rural areas in our state would never have received many of these services if it were not for the ability of the utilities to use county road rights of way and use them at no cost. We appreciate that fact. We recognize the significance of our partnership with utilities, and we appreciate the benefit that the public, our common constituents, have received. However, times have changed in Oregon. Since the early days of the Rural Electrification Initiative, public use of the road right of way for transportation in the form of higher traffic volumes and freight mobility has increased to the point that most of our roads, our county roads, have nearly grown out of the available right-of-way. Design standards and public expectations have placed a huge demand for better, wider, safer roadways and clear zones. All of these factors highlight the need for public agencies like ours to work closely with our utility industry partners, and I call them partners because they are our partners. We share the right-of-way. It's imperative that we work closely with our partners in making certain that we use the rights-of-way entrusted to us by the public in the most economical and efficient way possible. So working closely with utilities to ensure safety and mobility of the traveling public requires a high level of interaction with the utilities. With respect to consulting, reviewing, and permitting their location along the public right-of-way. This high level of interaction comes at a high cost to the public agency. This is particularly burdensome when you place it in context with our shrinking revenues, our increased operating costs due to labor, materials, equipment, not to mention complying with environmental regulations that are also out there to protect the public interest. So basically, I believe that it's our utility partners, that our utility partners have a responsibility to share this burden placed on public agencies by paying a reasonable fee for the privilege of occupying the public right-of-way at little or no cost. The purpose of this fee would be to offset our cost with respect to the consulting, reviewing, and permitting for safe and efficient location of utilities in the right-of-way. If allowed, Linn County would seek to recover our administrative costs only. We have no desire to generate revenue, certainly not in excess of the amount needed to relieve us of the burden we now carry alone. This would result in better coordination with our utility partners, faster turnaround time on permits, and safer and more efficient use of the public right-of-way. Just for example, from 2006 to the end of 2008, in my department, we issued 935 right-of-way encroachment permits. The cost to our agency, as we track it in our cost accounting system, was approximately $231,415. That includes processing the permits, inspecting before and after. We recovered approximately $29,567 of those costs from permits that were not exempt from a fee. An average permit fee of $125 would have covered half of our administrative costs and nearly quadrupled our fee revenue. So, I mean, what I'm asking you to do is not, I'm not here to talk about franchise fees or revenue generation for road departments and to, you know, cover our costs other than the permit issuing process, issuing and making sure that they comply with permits and that we have timely and adequate coordination. So I really, once again, I thank you for this opportunity to present my testimony, and I request your support for a reasonable permit fee, and I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone may have.
Thank you. Do you see any questions? No. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I'm going to call Brant Wolf, Danelle Romain, and Sandy Flicker.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association. The OTA represents 30 telephone companies that operate throughout the state of Oregon. Not surprisingly, we are here in opposition to House Bill 2042. We have some concerns with this bill. I'll be as brief as I can. You have my written comments in front of you. Basically, this bill would allow a new fee to be implemented on Oregonians, our customers. I think it's a pass-through right straight to them, and this probably is not the right time to be implementing new taxes and fees on Oregonians. There's no certainty in the bill about how this fee is structured, if it's based on gross revenues or per linear foot of facilities along the right-of-way. Depending on that aspect of this, it could be very, very expensive for some of those companies serving rural Oregon. We've heard a lot about why we don't pay this fee or why, you know, we are able to be in the right of way free of charge. And it's true. I mean, it's more expensive to serve rural Oregon than it is some more densely populated urban areas. And the lack of a fee at present is due in no small part to the fact that it was kind of an incentive to get deploy services out in rural Oregon. I will only state the obvious. It's not less expensive to do that now. It's only more expensive to do that. And I'll just leave it at that. As I understand it, this bill was one of the bills that came out of the Timber Task Force to replace those lost timber tax dollars. And those timber tax dollars went to fund general fund types of issues, as I understand it, libraries and other services. To the extent that this fee would backfill and support those general fund types of services, we would have some concerns with that as well, because then it's not a right-of-way fee, really. It's just a general fee to be used however the county sees fit. I'll just stop there. I'll answer any questions you have, and I'll just defer to my colleagues.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I represent the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association. I, too, will state very quickly that we are opposed to House Bill 2042, and I'm going to make some comments very specifically based on the impact on rural electric cooperatives. I have passed out my infamous colored map that shows the amount of territory in Oregon that are served by rural electric cooperatives. We serve in 34 of 36 counties. We serve only about 30 to 35 very small cities in Oregon. So obviously we are the primary county provider of electricity in Oregon. But that only represents 7 customers per mile of line, in some cases 1 customer for every 2 miles of line in Harney County, which has the largest service territory of any co-op in the United States. This is a tremendous amount of service territory for us to deliver electricity to, with very, very, very few people to pay the costs of that delivery system out there. This bill very much has a disproportionate effect on rural electric co-op customers. It is an issue of, cost, which is exactly what Mr. Wolf referred to. We serve the most disadvantaged counties in the state. These are the most distressed at the current point in time. We pay a property tax. We pay property taxes, and in lieu of formula on all of our lines and poles, and we have over 26,000 miles of lines in our service territories. So we believe that we pay for that privilege to be in those rights of way and to provide electricity to those very rural customers in Oregon, and believe that this is a double hit for our customers if they're asked to pay an additional cost on top of what we already pay. So I will also be very, very brief in my comments. I think Mr. Wolf covered most of the relevant points, but I just wanted to make sure that you clearly understood the impact of rural electric co-op customers of a franchise fee of this nature. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Danelle Romaine, representing the Oregon People's Utility District Association, and I will be brief as well and echo some of what Sandy said. The OPUDA represents six electric PUDs throughout the state. We serve over 115,000 customers. We provide 415 family wage jobs in the state, providing over $33 million in wages to local, mostly rural communities. We pay property taxes and franchise fees that get passed down to customers on their electric bills. We're some of the largest taxpayers in the county. In 2008, we paid over $7.4 million to cities and counties in property taxes. And we believe that we'd be disproportionately affected by this type of fee because many of our utilities serve in multiple counties. For example, Central Lincoln PUD paid over $1 million in property taxes in 2008 and sits in Lincoln, Lane, Douglas, and Coos counties. So I would just urge you to vote no on this bill, and be happy to answer any questions. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This could be for any one of you. On electric rates, I'm going to show my naivety here, but I don't pay my electric bill. My wife does that. Do we break down the taxes on our electric bill when it comes out? And you receive your electric bill, does it break down how much you're paying for city, state taxes? I know the phone bill does, but I think there's still some hidden the phone bill.
Chair Beyer, Representative Widener, I can speak for Central Lincoln because they've talked to me about this, that they, I believe it's a choice on the utility bill, but they have in the past put a line item on the bill for certain city taxes, and I'm guessing they would as well for this tax if it were to be imposed.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, we do have the ability to put the city franchise tax on the bill if it's over a certain percentage. This is not addressed in House Bill 2042 whether we would have that opportunity to do that or not. In fact, this is a very open-ended piece of legislation in terms of how this could be trying to think of the word I want to say. Administered. It has no caps. It has no information at all about what the counties could or could not charge or whether we would be able to put it on the bill or not. We are able to do that with the city tax, with the city franchise fees.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question, I guess, is as the counties find themselves more and more limited because of the 3% lid on raising property taxes, they, I suppose, are looking for these other alternatives. And I'm just curious, if this device was used, who isn't actually paying? In other words, this franchise fee would be picked up by the very same people who pay the property tax, I guess. Is that a correct assumption, or is it a narrower group?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, one thing I did neglect to make sure I pointed out, and that is that electric cooperatives are nonprofit utilities. So our rates are based on our costs. Any costs that are imposed upon the utility are paid by our customers. So this is definitely a cost that would be passed on to each and every one of our customers in their rates.
Follow up.
Correct. And I'm just trying to find out if that's the exact same people who would like to maybe pay more tax, but there's a limit. They need to repair their roads. So this device, would it, if it was used, would the same people be paying the franchise fee that would otherwise be paying the higher property tax, if not limited by the 3% lid?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, yes. These are the same people that pay the property tax through their rates from us and pay their property tax on their homes and businesses. They're exactly the same people who would be paying this through their telephone rates, electricity rates. It would be a multiple tax impact because of most people are served by multiple utilities. So, yes, it is exactly the same people.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you. I hope I can ask this clearly. I'm just using your map, Sandy. Do any of these counties, is there timber in taking what Brant mentioned that this fee would represent or would replace this timber tax? Do any of these have no timber in them that would replace? That's kind of a backwards way of asking.
I'm not sure who you're asking, but I think particularly in Southeast Oregon there, mm-hmm. I mean, that's the place that if it's based on a per linear foot of facilities, then they would pay the most, and I don't know how much timber is in, you know, the Alvord Desert, but I'm guessing it's not much.
Well, that's kind of my point. I was follow up on that. If I could see that nexus, if they were told to go out, if the task force came out and said, here's an opportunity, you could, you know, some of this could be replaced. But because you're all PUDs and you don't all have timber, or they don't, all these counties don't have timber in them, or the service areas, I guess, it's not counties. But it just seems to me it might be unfair to these guys down here in that sense. Do you know if that's...
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, I think, if I understand it, you know, this is a right being given to all counties, not just counties that get timber receipts or have lost a percentage of timber receipts. So you're right. If House Bill 2042 were to pass, it would allow any county in the state, whether they were affected by timber receipts or not, to then... apply this tax.
Yeah, final follow-up. So Multnomah County would also be able to do this, for example.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, I believe so. I don't think in the bill it gives any counties, an exemption from the opportunity to levy this tax.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Benz.
Madam Chair, we heard from Mr. Lane of Linn County that in his opinion, the utilities were not paying enough to pay for the damage or permit fees. I'm not sure which it was. But in your opinion, is that a similar circumstance across the counties that your utility serves, or do you think the utility is paying its fair share of the cost it imposes upon those roads?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, we are responsible to repair any road damage that we cause by working in the right-of-ways. And so in my estimation, we cover any damage that we may do to county property. I think that, you know, this is clearly, a policy issue of, you know, whether you want to assess county residents twice or not. I think, you know, I sympathize with the counties and their need to find sources of revenue. Absolutely. We just don't believe this is the appropriate way to find it.
I don't disagree.
I don't see any other questions. I guess it's not in reading Mr. Lane's comments. It isn't even so much the damage to the road, it's the permitting and the inspections, because I think we all want to be good stewards of our property, and we're paying for those roads, so we want to make sure that they're kept in good repair, so there has to be at least some oversight. So I think that's probably not so much paying that they're having to pay to repair the damage for the roads. They're just having to pay to make sure that the permitting's done, the work's done right, and the repairs are done right so that our roads actually will hold up. So I think that's the message there that we should be getting. So thank you.
Thanks.
And I'm going to call Tom Gallagher and Gary Bauer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Gallagher representing PGE. I agree with the comments of my colleagues and won't duplicate those, but I'll add a couple of other more than technicalities, but problems with the bill. We in the utilities do view this, while it is a fee technically under the law, it's a tax that we'll pass on to our customers. We pay also permit fees in most jurisdictions to get into the right-of-way. I'm not sure why some jurisdictions don't charge them, but they can charge for permits. We're obligated to return roads and streets back to the same level which we took them out. I do understand that every time you cut into a piece of asphalt, it creates a problem, but these are services that we're performing for people that are there and that in using our services, our utility services. And the changing many times, and you see language in here that says the jurisdiction can ask us to go in and change our alignment, to move our poles and to go underground and do these other things. So many times we're in the right-of-way at the request of the jurisdiction. So we don't like franchise fees or privilege fees. They get passed on directly. What this bill doesn't talk about is the amount of the fees. In fact, it's very dim on how the fees are raised. I would assume that it's the language in line 28 on page 1 of the bill. It doesn't say how much. It doesn't say where the money goes. So people have come in and talked about it going back into roads. If you want to put it in roads, do it. City franchise fees are general fund monies. Now, I'm not here to argue that all the jurisdictions have difficulty under Measure 50 and under the timber tax reaching their revenue goals, but there are more direct ways that this body can solve those problems, and I think ultimately we're going to have to go back and revisit Measure 50. Let me just talk about a real complexity here between the way that with a PUC-regulated utility, how the city franchise fees are currently handled. Right now there's a 3% charge that the PUC allows to be passed on in the rates, and that means that goes back to every ratepayer in the area. So if you're in the city or out of the city, there's been a long case law development inside the PUC as to why that's a fair way to share this cost, as Ms. Flicker talked about. So there's a 3%. There's another provision that says the cities can go above 3%, but if they do that, it has to go as a line item on the bill. So there are cities that have gone up as high as 5%. So there's another 5% charge there. That charge only goes on the city residents. So the 3% spread across the whole service territory, another additional charge on the city residents. If you're going to add another fee here for the counties, I think we're going to have to go back and revisit these. We're going to have to say, what are we doing here? I mean, these are the services that a monopoly utility has to provide to people under their obligation to serve. We have to be there. It's the people's right-of-way. It's the people's electricity. And it's the people that want them in the right-of-way and doing that work. It's the people that want these improvements made. So if you're going to have a city fee and a county fee, maybe they should be paid by the county fee by the people in the county, the city fee by the people in the city. To do that, you've got to go back and put some language in this bill to do that, because we got to overturn some of the PUC decisions and so forth. So we've really opened up a ball of wax here just practically. It's not so easy to go ahead and just pass this bill and move forward and come out with a very fair outcome. If you do decide to go forward with this, we would be happy to sit down with the PUC folks in the cities and the counties and try to figure out how to sort out who pays these fees, what they are, where they go, how they work. If they're a replacement for general tax revenue, then, let's get it done on a fair tax basis, not just on you're in our road and you're in our right-of-way. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. And I'd like to start by saying we also appreciate the partnership that we have with the counties, that it is a two-way street. We work well with them. We spend a lot of time, our engineers do, on almost every project. And these projects range from not just putting a line down a right-of-way, but providing service off of that line to individual residential customers, which, again, as has been mentioned, are also the taxpayers. So we share the commonality in terms of who is actually in the end paying for these projects. As has been mentioned, I'll be quick, the legislation doesn't set up any process. It doesn't tell us whether it's a permit fee, a franchise fee based on miles, based on gross sales, which is how cities actually assess it. It's basically a sales tax on utilities. For municipalities, generally the franchise revenues that they get from gas, electric, telecommunications, cable, when you roll all that together, it's the second major funding source next to property taxes for municipalities. So when folks talk about a replacement to timber tax revenues, that's, I think, in part what makes utilities concerned, that we become the general fund collection mechanism for counties. Recognize they have issues and they have concerns, and we really are willing to kind of help them figure out how to do that. For us, as much as Tom mentioned, we do relocate our facilities. For Northwest Natural, that's one of our largest uncontrollable costs anymore, is we're constantly moving facilities to basically accommodate, they may be road projects, they may be developer-related projects, but we're constantly moving facilities. We do those at our expense. And so that's, again, one reason we have some nervousness about a process that tells you to move your facilities and come back and also pay again as a result of going through that process. And if you do this, we would like to see actually a full review of the whole, how you're going to assess the fees on utilities and have some transparency in it. I agree with the counties. They do pay. Their residents do pay a portion of what is in our rates for city services. And that's a discussion, I think, if we're going to go through this and look at fees, whether they're in the counties or cities, then we ought to have a wide open discussion and talk about transparency. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I don't see any questions. I'm going to ask Ralph Broner to come up, and I don't know if Art wants to join him in case there are any questions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ralph Groner. I'm with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Hopefully, I'll rebut some of the points I've heard here against the proposal by the counties. A little background. I did spend 8 years as a county commissioner. I also spent my time on planning commissions and land use, so I just heard some things that were rather strange considering we're talking counties, not urban growth boundaries that cities have. I just want to say this. This really is, I think there are four revenue members on this committee. This really becomes an issue, the governor's commission that I just spent a year and a half on, dealing with tax reform in Oregon, where the counties, we all learned, and if Paul Warner were in front of this committee, you would find we face not the kitty dog thing that was up here the other day, but the fact is counties are going under. That's the experts of Oregon. Counties have only a limited, maybe a decade, time left in Oregon. And when I was commissioner, for example, I use this as an example, we were able, pre-Measure 5, pre-Measure 4750, we were able to pay for all planning for counties, it's property tax. Their general fund is property tax. We were able to pay, and ONC revenue if you're an ONC county. That goes into the general fund. Federal forest receipts, other than ONC, are specifically for highways and education, etc. So we were able to pay for program after program, including animal control, including public health, including mental health, including senior programs, including libraries. I picked my county, Clackamas County. It epitomizes the state of counties, including Tillamook, in Oregon. The fact of the matter, they're all gone. They're gone. Our public health system is gone. is going into and is will be privatized. Our mental health system is being challenged by all counties, whether they can afford to do it any longer. Our programs for everything is off the right-of-way because it wasn't Measure 5 alone. It was Measure 50 and the 3% cap that has no floor, Measure 5 does. I'm into revenue, but this relative to this issue. The cities, in the meantime, also have problems, but they also have unique opportunities under Measure 4750, and that let's take highways. I served on Clackamas County's Transportation Advisory Panel for a year. The city of Oregon City, where I live, as 9 of our 17 cities, have now gone out with a $5 or whatever per month on my utility rate for local highways because we hadn't had a transportation tax since what? It's 93. If I'm wrong, I'm sorry, but 1993, neither had we had federal gas tax increase. So the cities in Oregon have been able to go to the utility fee because they're where utilities are. It's awfully hard for a county to do that when, in fact, they're sitting out in the boondocks, at least in my county, and how do you do that there? You don't. What am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that if the cost for Linn County is $200,000 the applications, etc., that money came from the following. If you're a county commissioner, and some have been, you know that your general fund primarily funds public safety, human service, same as here, except education. And the fact of the matter is every time you don't have $200,000 any longer, the good old days are gone. I have been begging the revenue committees to hold a joint hearing on the crisis facing counties and cities and special districts in this state. If I sound animated, it's because that should have been a priority over everything in this building other than getting this general fund fixed because they're going under. And when they go under, the state goes under because they are your human resource provider. So when you say, oh, it's only $200,000, then you compare that $200,000 to half of them having to pass it on to me, the ratepayer, monthly, when $200,000 means three deputies gone, and maybe one of my public health clinics gone, and after a while that $200,000 is $200,000. We no longer are able to pay for anything with general fund because it's gone. We now are paying, and we're now the nation's number one or number two in the nation in fees. We're second highest in income tax. So the fact is, the reason we're fees is because the ballot measures the public have passed, and as much as I really do care for the wonderful lobbyists who have been up there, the counties are sinking faster than cities because they don't have their general law. Many are. They're not all home rule as cities are. So, bottom line, counties are in trouble. The governor's commission recommended it, understood it. Everyone else understands it. And the only reason they're now being asked to pay for their share of at least helping offset the cost to the counties is the alternative is to reduce further your public safety and those kind of programs that the counties are currently having to shed. If I sounded animated, I'm sorry. It's more about the ballot measures the public have passed on to counties than it is anything. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Thank you for coming, Mr. Groner. It's always a pleasure. I would submit to you and anyone who's willing to listen that we've painted ourselves into this corner. The right wing in this state has convinced us into saying taxes and government are bad, and the left wing has convinced us into saying using land for industry, manufacturing, agriculture, timber, water development, the list goes on, is bad as well. And here we are. And you know what? If folks think that lean government is good, well, we're going to get a good, healthy dose of lean government this session. And you know what, Ralph? I don't think necessarily in the long run that's necessarily a bad thing. People have to know what they're voting for and voting on. And the people in this state want to have their cake and eat it too. And they ain't going to get any cake and they ain't even going to eat. But I will tell you, I do appreciate you and your efforts, not just on the tax code side, the revenue side, but on the fiscal side, the ability, the way to get out there and create policy that does get us access to the things we're blessed with and rich with in this state. So I just wanted to thank you for coming. I know you're passionate and animated, and I'm grateful for that. But once again, we are getting everything that we asked for.
Thank you. Okay, I don't see any questions for him. Did anyone have, I know, I assume this was your note.
Yes.
You didn't sign it.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
Do you want to clarify the comments?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I thank you for giving me the opportunity to maybe clarify or respond to the question of Representative Boone and the question about the nexus between the governor's timber task force report and at least part of what we're here talking about in terms of the impact of, you know, utilities being in the right-of-way. There are only four of the 36 counties that do not receive any timber, federal timber payment money at this point. And as you know, we are on a course that within the next 3 years, that money will entirely go away. It's in a declining balance over the next 3 years. Up till this last year, what we'll lose in terms of money for highways is approximately $100 million statewide that is divided between the 32 counties that get money. The $100 million is all to roads. It is not any of it is general fund. There is another pot of money at this point that is also being lost that goes to general funds at this point. So, you know, each county that is receiving money, it's a little different depending upon the cut of from the federal forests. I can tell you at the higher end, like Lane County, which is at the high end, they're losing about $17 million annually to their road fund. Now, there are other counties that won't lose anywhere near that, but it gives you an idea. And some counties are losing more than 50% of the money that's currently going into the road fund. The four counties that are not getting any money right now from federal forest are Clatsop, because they, and you say, boy, they got lots of timber. Well, it's state timber. It's state forest. It's not federal forest that's in Clatsop County. Sherman and Gillum counties and Malheur, those are the four counties at this point that do not get any federal timber money. So I just wanted to clarify, you've heard from three counties, I believe, Lane, Lynn, and Clackamas, with regard to just the coordination effort and the review that they do in terms of trying to make sure that when a utility does do something, that, you know, they get a permit, but there's no charge for that permit, that the counties are expending, you know, somewhere between, let's say, $250,000, and they're not being able to recoup that. And that doesn't count the damage to the roads. And, yes, I would note that when a utility cuts a road, they are required to bring it back to the way it was before. Only trouble is the life of the road is not the same as it was before it was cut, because there's a cut, water seeps in, there's settling and other kinds of stuff, and so it does have an impact on the life of the road every time. And I know everybody's seen, you know, a road that almost is brand new, and then pretty soon there's a cut here, and there's a cut here, and there's a cut here, and then you can feel that. I know I can in my car when I go down the road and hit all of those. So just talking about transportation, not talking about county general fund, we're looking at, you know, a sizable amount of money that's being diverted from, let's say, the road program, or from the road program that is being used to do the coordination with the utilities, which we all agree needs to be done. So I hope that helps put things in perspective.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, on my drive down this morning, I was listening to the radio, and I heard of a state that was doing something unique, or it was a city. And I'm wondering if it wouldn't work here. It was actually KFC was fixing the potholes and taking care of the roads, and the ones that they fixed said was refreshed by KFC. What if we let the utility companies maintain the roads and they could put refreshed by whatever utility company?
PGE.
Yep. So that way we could defer some of this. I thought it was a rather unique idea and make our roads very interesting.
Okay.
We might know where our fees go to then.
I do have a quick question, because I think we've heard that you can charge from the utilities, that you can charge for these permits, but can you charge for the permits or not? Are you?
Chair Barr, my understanding, and Darren Lane's here, and he issues the permits. My understanding is that a permit, you come in and get the permit, and you go through the process, but there is no fee that is charged for that permit. It is free, because counties cannot choose for a utility to be in the right-of-way.
Cities can.
So. Okay. Thank you for
that. Thank you for the opportunity to clarify.
Thank you for all coming back today. And I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2042. And I'm going to go ahead and open a work session, since I have everybody here, on House Bill 2385. And Patrick, you want to remind us what we're doing?
Thanks, Madam Chair. House Bill 2385, we heard this bill way back on January 30th. This is the one that prohibits smoking in a motor vehicle while a person age 16 or younger is in the vehicle. Creates a graduated fine schedule for first, second, and subsequent offenses. You have attached to your packet here a minimal expenditure impact fiscal analysis, as well as a no revenue impact statement for the measure. No amendments, Madam Chair.
So, committee, this is the bill that we have in front of us, and I'm willing to...
Are we entertaining a motion?
Yes, we are entertaining a motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2385. Is that correct? To the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Call has moved House Bill 2385 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm having troubles with the minimal expenditure impact when I just got a bill back that basically required to call to find out if a juvenile who was pregnant or had had sex with somebody, a 15-year-old. It was just a simple call. Was it a 24-year-old uncle, or was it your 15-year-old boyfriend or 17-year-old boyfriend? And they told me that was going to cost us $120 million, and we couldn't do that. So when we have people smoking in the cars with children, I can't see it being minimal when people start calling in to report these people for doing illegal activity. I think the fiscal is going to be much higher on that if my bill, which is just as simple, doesn't come back as minimal and they put 120 and it's dealing with rape and getting tossed out. So I have a big problem with this.
Any other comments? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to vote for this bill. Then it dawned on me that we had just imposed a series of restrictions on smokers that just took effect. Some very onerous ones, and I've heard much about them. And it strikes me that this bill would be better positioned if it was 2 years from now. And I hope that I'm back here and I have a chance to view it if it doesn't pass now at that time, because I can see the value of the bill clearly. And there's a bunch of good excuses that can be made about enforcement and about cost and about danger when someone tries to hide their cigarette when they think a police officer is looking at them. But the truth of it is we are piling on these folks, and it's amazing how reliant we're becoming on them because of our tax problems. But I'll simply say we're piling on, and so I'll be voting no this time, and I hope I get an opportunity to vote again in 2 years.
Thank you. Representative Schaffler?
I will be supporting the bill, although I would like to comment to what Representative Bent spoke to, and I agree, even though I voted for the ban, I believe we did go pretty far there, and there will be a bill in business and labor. Hopefully we can get some flexibility into our ability to have a cigar in this, or a cigarette if you choose, disgusting habit cigarettes, have a cigar in a public venue indoors. So there's hope, Representative, but I guess I'll just end by saying smoke them if you got them.
Representative Call.
Yeah, I'd just like to to me, I think this while I support generally the regulations we've put in place around smoking, I think that this one is just one that's long overdue. The Surgeon General under George W. Bush, whose name escapes me right now, issued a report, I think 2 or 3 years ago, that said that there is no level of secondhand smoke that is safe. And that to me is the absolute reason why I'm voting yes on this, that there are children riding in cars with adults and that there is no level of secondhand smoke that they can consume that is safe for them. That to me is the most compelling reason why I would support this. And I do understand the concerns about piling on with smokers, but when we're talking about children and we're talking about the fact that there is no level of secondhand smoke that is safe for them, I don't want to wait. So those are my thoughts.
Thank you. Representative Bone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I piggyback on Rep. Call's comments, and that's why I'm voting for this too, is that if a child can choose not to be in the car and drive themselves or whatever, that's another issue. But these are cases where there are young children and babies in these cars and they have no choice. And the window's up or down or doesn't matter, but in the winter you assume, which we have a lot of around here, the windows will be up. And if it's a long trip, there could be continual smoke for an hour, whatever. In any case, that's my point, is that a child does not have a choice, therefore this is something we can do to help protect the children. So.
Thank you. Representative Schaffler. And then
I really want to just pile on with Representative Call and Representative Boons, especially relating to children being exposed to secondhand smoke. I couldn't agree more. That's why I believe this bill has merit. But I just want to clarify, any bill in the Cost of Business and Labor Committee will strictly be limited to a small, narrow environments where only adults will be allowed in. There will be no children allowed in these, in anything we attempt to do. And to Representative Widener, if you, and I love Ken Rocco and the people down there, but if you discover and solve the mysteries of LFO, I'd be the first one to want to know. So.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It used to be that we went from the assumption that parents cared deeply for their children and did things to support and wouldn't put them in harm's way. And we know that that's not exactly the truth. But the fact of the matter is most parents do feel that way. They don't smoke in cars. They don't smoke at all. And those that do and are irresponsible in lots of other ways, too. I think this is a slippery slope where you get to, oh, well, smoking in your house is dangerous. You can't do that. If smoking is a legal activity, then this crosses some sort of a line for me in the sand as to where we can regulate. We Americans kind of think our cars are kind of personal space, and I can't get here. I'm sorry. Not that I'm not cognizant of the irresponsibility of a parent driving down the street with kids in it smoking. That happens. There's an awful lot of far awfuler things going on out here that I would rather my police were looking out for than a smoking parent. This is not where I think the state should be going. We should be concentrating on an awful lot of other far more important criminal activities than taking over and saying you are a bad parent and therefore criminalized for doing illegal activity within your car. I'm sorry, can't go here.
Thank you, Representative.
I love this conversation, and I have great respect for all my colleagues on this committee. The fact of the matter is driving a car in America is a highly regulated privilege.
I understand.
It's not a right. It's a highly regulated privilege. And I believe not only is there a health issue here, there's a safety issue. So I hate to disagree or argue with my friend from Salem, but I just had to throw that in there.
But we love to argue, Madam Chair.
That's
you
right.
Can see the
we
last
do.
Representative Widener.
If we're going here, why don't we just ban smoking and cigars altogether? That's what I don't understand. I mean, we're causing damage, secondhand smoke. We're going into people's automobiles, homes. I mean, this is a perfect nanny state bill. And, I mean, if we're going to be a nanny state, why don't we get rid of government's addiction to tobacco altogether? I mean, why are we using tobacco to fund our seniors and disabled bus service? Why do we have 1% going to bike trails and not 1% of our budget going to fund seniors and disabled? And we're using cigarettes to piggyback on the back. And this is, it's just wrong for us to even be looking at this, addressing this bill. And if smoking is that detrimental and causing that much damage, we need to go about it the right way and just bring a bill forward that bans smoking in the state of Oregon.
Representative Call and then Edwards.
Yes. Just to piggyback on what Representative Schaffler had to say, there is a fundamental difference between your home and your car, and it is recognized in law. You have a diminished expectation of privacy in your car. There are so many ways in which a police officer and the state, let's be very frank about this, in which the state can intrude into your privacy within a car already, that to allow the state to come into that car in this context, I mean, it just seems to me like not such a significant thing. And there is a sanctity of the home that no one I can imagine in this place would ever transgress. And honestly, the people in this place who are actively advocating for this measure would honestly potentially not support it if they felt like there was a capacity to increase the rights to privacy in the cars. But we don't have that capacity. And since we treat cars differently, since we are not going to be able to expand a right to privacy in a person's car, this is not a very far distance to go for me.
Thank you. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be a yes vote on this bill. My concerns about the health of Oregonian children outweighs my qualms about imposing further restrictions on personal freedom in cars. I don't believe this is a slippery slope. As legislators, we have to make fine distinctions. That's our job. And I think this bill has the requisite merit to warrant a yes vote.
Thank you. Representative Widener again.
I know we're a little late in the game, but I would almost like to see the penalty parenting classes then. If we're going to have a penalty for this, it should be parenting classes.
I think that's probably a good amendment to look at for the Senate when it goes over there. I don't see any other comments. I just want to say that having grown up, and I never really put this together until actually we started talking about this bill in committee, I grew up with parents both who smoked all the time, and being locked up in a car with two parents smoking and five kids. I got car sick a lot. I never really put these two together, but I'm sure there was a connection. I just think at that point in time, people didn't know how dangerous cigarette smoke was. And they do now. And I think that given that, there's really no excuse anymore for people to put their kids in those kind of situations. And with that, I am going to go ahead.
One quick one, Madam Chair.
Right. Representative Widener.
You're not that old.
Oh, I am. And I feel it more every day. Would you like to take the roll call?
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Bench?
No.
Representative Berger?
No.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
No.
Representative Gilman?
No.
Representative Call?
Aye.
Chair Beyer?
Aye. House Bill 2385 have received the requisite number of votes and is declared passed. And we will ask Representative Riley if he'll carry the bill. And I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2385 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3047. And Patrick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This measure, House Bill 3047, directs TriMet to implement a pilot project to use volunteer greeters on light rail vehicles to improve user safety, decrease fare evasion, and decrease criminal activity.
Thank you. And we'll go ahead and get... is he on his way? Well, we're going to go ahead and stand at ease and wait for the sponsor of the bill to come down. I think he's on his way.
It could have been a more exciting.
Order or whatever the phrase is. So reconvene, yes. And Representative Smith, would you like to come up and talk to us about your bill?
Okay. And I think he's getting Representative Call, who may want to speak as well. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. As all of us probably did during the months of March to May and the months of perhaps May to November, we went and visited lots of people in our districts to talk to them about what was on their mind and asking for their help. When I did that in my district, every time, and I at some point kept track enough that I believe that it is not an exaggeration when I say every time, the subject of public transit and the MAX came up. The response I got at the doorstep was either, I won't ride, I won't let my wife ride, I won't let my daughter ride. And I don't believe there was a time that the topic came up, and it was at least a dozen times, where that wasn't said. I say this as a proponent not only of public transit, but also of MAX specifically, as a really important asset to the people in my district to link them both west and east with the broader things the area has to offer, particularly in an area that was, and I will say this on the record multiple times, was unconstitutionally annexed by the city of Portland, unconstitutionally annexed as determined by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, but there was no remedy on remand so that it stuck, but it's still unconstitutional. And the MAX line is a critical asset among not enough public assets for people in that community. Met with TriMet after this, and they were very sensitive to the issue, and they have made since then, and prior to our meeting, of course, some laudable progress and laudable efforts on this. And I think they would be the first to admit there is still much to do and far to go. I will also acknowledge that this is a problem that is also a perception problem. The fear of riding on MAX exceeds the reality, but the reality is not false. And so I do not feel afraid to ride MAX in the least. But if we are going to increase ridership, it is not enough for somebody who is 6'3 and 200 and more pounds it's like 240, unfortunately, to feel safe, but also others. So there's a number of things that we can do about this. The three, and I also talked to public safety folks, and I heard three basic plans. The first plan was close the system, not shut it down, but essentially turnstile it, right? Make it so you can't get on a train or you can't get on a platform unless you pay and go through a turnstile. The challenge of that is very expensive, in some places impossible, and to some people a little jackbooted. Second proposal is more police officers. No objection to that. They've done some of that. They've increased the police presence on the MAX, which I think is really a gift. And every time they do it, it costs them a buck and a quarter. It's about $125,000, $130,000 for every additional police officer we add. When you talk about person, benefits, car, and training, okay, it's about $250,000 for every pair. That you can't do too many pairs at $250,000 a piece under current budget challenges. There was another set of proposals, one that I am largely stealing and the other I am not. I will offer both. The bill before you regards one. The first, and I will then go to the second, which is the bill before you. The first would be visible ticketing. Instead of having a little ticket that you print and put in your pocket, and then a transit officer has to ask you, you know, racial profile, whatever, you know, age profile, noise profile, kindness profile, best guess, whatever it is. Hey, did you pay? Or just doing it randomly. Instead, they can ticket profile. Same way we do it with cars parked downtown. Get a little sticker in the window, you know whether or not somebody has paid. I think that would go a long ways to, and Commander Krebs and Police Chief Rosie Sizer have both endorsed the plan of visible ticketing, at the very least trying it out. They just like to do it, but know that probably would require some trying out. I don't know if they would know that. They would not object to trying it out, nor would I. Because it would make their jobs a lot easier rather than having to arrest a person, take them off the train, spend the next blank number of minutes or hours processing them one by one. They could issue citations more quickly and be much more efficient. And also, the reason Commander Krebs, who is the head of the East Precinct in my district, likes the visible ticketing idea is because his anticipation would be that peer pressure would lead to significant reductions in scofflawing. People would see who else was wearing a ticket or holding a ticket. Could be a sticker, could be a lanyard. If you didn't want to put it on your suede coat, you could hold it in your hand. Second and last, and then I'll be quiet and defer to my colleague, Representative Call. The second proposal that is before you is transit greeters, just like we do at Walmart, just like we do at Fred Meyer. Walmart and Fred Meyer have greeters when people come into the store, not because merely they are nice citizens of the town and they want people to feel good, but because they have good data that it reduces shoplifting. Somebody says, hey, thanks for coming to Walmart. Thanks for coming to Fred Meyer. Not only does a person feel watched, but they also feel more like a human. So if we could have transit greeters on the MAX, I think also in combination with visible ticketing, it would go a huge measure of the way to assisting the police department in making our transit feel safe and be safe. Some of the details I will leave to, happy to answer questions, leave to Representative Call, happy also to leave it to some of the other folks who are testifying, but that's a little bit of it.
Representative Schaffler had a question.
Thank you, Representatives, for bringing this, and it clearly this max goes right through your districts. It's going to go along the western border of mine and cut through a peninsula of mine, and I'm confident many of my constituents already do, and even more will use max. And I've always felt comfortable on it, too. I've been on these systems all over the country and parts of the world, and I've never really felt threatened. That being said, you're right. There is a problem. And I want to thank you, Representative Smith, for giving me at least one good thing to say about Walmart as well. But because I've been struggling mightily looking for one. And I have a fourth option, which every citizen should pack heat, of course, with a concealed weapon permit, of course. But my question to you, sir, is, and I don't even know where TriMet is on this, have you done any, and maybe Representative Call was going to get to this, the idea of liability on these good greeters, and who's going to pay for that insurance if that's required, and their safety and their training. Now, I feel we need to do something, and I'm not saying this is not what is not the answer. Maybe it is, but I think those questions just pop into my brain automatically. So, but I do appreciate you bringing this to the legislature's attention, believe me.
I'll say a few things, and I can leave more to TriMet and people who are smarter than I am, and Representative Call included among them.
Why, thank you.
The first thing I'd say is there is nobody, and this doesn't challenge what you said, but merely to allay concern, nobody is suggesting, you know, arming them, and more importantly than that, nobody is suggesting that any sort of transit greeter would confront, merely observe and report. Right, and that every other, and one of the people testifying has a specific plan of how one might implement it, but I don't think anybody would implement this, and somebody like Commander Krebs would not be in favor of it if there weren't confidence that we'd work towards an implementation plan that that would garner confidence. But we've seen, at least in the private sector, we have seen, you know, greeter situations work and safety officer situations work where somebody received a little bit of training, and not very much training, just a little bit of training, and wasn't empowered or instructed to confront. In fact, quite the opposite. And all they were armed with was a cell phone or a walkie-talkie and a red jersey. So I think that would be the first thing. And the other thing I would say is the other alternatives, and there are people in my district who have discussed this. We think that that is a better route. And one of the reasons for all of those things, we think that's a better route than sort of a vigilante situation where, you know, you leave it to the law of the jungle, and heck, you don't even need a conceal and carry permit if you're willing to show your gun, and we could just have, you know, and we can debate, you know. I think your gun plan and this plan could coexist.
Thank you, Representative. I don't have a bill, Madam Chair.
Oh, good. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I love closing for Representative Schaffler. So we actually are an open carry state, so if you leave it out in the open, you're fine.
That's true.
That's what I'm saying.
So, and my next question is, and TriMet will probably have to give it to me, but I think there's church groups that are riding MAX right now and doing this program. They were like a gray and black coats. I've seen it on the news several times, and they've discussed it with them. So I'm just wondering what the reaction is and what their plan is going forward, because I've heard of them breaking up fights several times and issues like that. So,
I think we should leave it to TriMet. I think we should leave it to some people. I really want to make sure we give Representative Call a chance to chat to it. And my first blush would be, I think if the challenge continues, I think it is inevitable that we will see more volunteer-driven, non-supervised responses, and that might not be terrible, but it might be terrible, and we might, whether it's the Guardian Angels or the Guardian Angels, right? We might, you know, there might be a reason to do this in a planned way.
Follow up. One reason for the follow-up is we don't want to give Representative Acala a chance to speak on this issue, but this kind of goes back to a bill we had earlier that makes me a little nervous when we get involved
when there's groups out there doing it already, because we had this issue with the weigh scales and the trucks and letting the weighmasters go run trucks down and what they could run into. And sometimes there could be dangerous situations. And if we're implementing it in ourselves as the state, now we become liable if for some reason someone was to get shot or beat to death. And that's the part that scares me with going this direction. I'd rather citizens come forward on their own without us being involved with this process.
I hear that and do want to defer to Representative Call and to TriMet on that question and say only this, that I do think we'd want to manage liability issues, both with what I said before and with good liability waivers. I also think that we are not necessarily clear from liability if there is a consistent pattern of personal intervention that we do not engage in the resolution of the same. Right? If we know there are a bunch of church ladies going and helping out, and they're intervening a bunch, and we just say, hey, let it happen, and then one of them dies, or two of them get beaten up, if we think we're really free just because we sort of let it happen, and that there's no liability risk there, I think we got another think coming.
Yes.
Turn off.
Representative Boone.
Sorry. Thank you. We were just imagining the Saturday Night Live church lady.
Yes. As was I.
I'll try to be serious. I was going to ask, you know, why you were doing this, but I've since heard that answered. But I do have a really burning question. And that is the bus project going to use this too?
They are all volunteer greeters. Every one of them is a transit greeter.
I had to do it. Thank you.
Representative Call. Before
thank
we get...
thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Nick Call, State Representative from House District 49. I'd first like to thank the good representative from unconstitutionally annexed East Portland for bringing this bill forward. I think you should switch from the Bedrock District to that. That would be very fun. this bill is pretty straightforward. There's a couple things I'd like to point out just right off the bat on it. First of all, Representative Smith has addressed this, but I wanted to as well for the record. There are more perceived problems on the MAC system than there actually than exist in reality. That said, when perception drives reality, people, whether or not there are real apparent dangers to the extent that they are perceived, people forego utilizing the MAC system because of that perceived danger. So whether or not the danger is as bad as people think it is, we need to, at the very least, address the perception so that people feel safe to get on the MAC line. And so I think that arguments about the level of danger that exists on the MAC line are beside the point. We need to create a system that people feel is safe so that they utilize it. And that's what this bill gets to. And this bill gets to that reality in just one way that I think is very important. It seeks to engage people in the system as it exists without disrupting it. It's what I've referred to as this and the other measure Representative Smith referred to and a few other ideas that have had. They seek to bolster the honor system. They seek to actually give everyone an opportunity to do the right thing. And I think that if you looked at any other major city in America and put a comprehensive transit system like we have with open platforms that you can just simply walk onto and train lines you can get onto without ever having to pay a fare or pass through a turnstile, I don't believe that any system in America in a major city would be as successful as ours is. And so while there are concerns about the MAX line, I think that it is amazing that we have an open system like we do that has as much utilization and as little problems as exist currently. And so these measures are an attempt to do what Jefferson Smith, Representative Smith, has referred to in the past as taking back the MAX. Rather than the state intervening and hardening the stations or doing any number of things that are costly and changing the nature of the system, What we're trying to do is allow the citizenry whose system it is to take it back for themselves and keep it as it exists now, based primarily on the honor system and understanding amongst people that we all benefit from this and therefore should pay for that benefit that we've gotten. And so this measure, the other measure we mentioned, and other things that we're going to bring forward are supported by TriMet and by people on all sides of this issue, because we're trying to maintain what we think is a fantastic system. And with that, I'll take any questions that may exist.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Call, Representative Smith, I think this is an absolutely fascinating and fantastic idea. I think there's a perception out there that sometimes some of these voluntary systems may be less effective than other methods, and yet data consistently shows otherwise. This is a continuation of the planning principle of eyes on the street, that creating a culture and a community of trust is something that is both cost effective as well as effective. And I think that this is precisely the kind of creative win-win that could really be a game changer. As a side note to your point about the MAX and the remarkable system that we have there, the chair will indulge a short story. I brought a friend from New York to Portland, and I used to live in New York myself, and she had to about pick her jaw up off the floor when she rode the MAX, because she said, quote, "I've never seen a public transit system based on the honor system before." And I explained to her that it's actually not the honor system, but nevertheless, there's a perception of openness there. And two, for anybody who's ever spent time in New York, a ride on the MAX in any portion of the MAX seems downright serene compared to their subways. So.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Representative Call, I'm hoping you will help me out on this, because I kept getting from Representative Smith that it was transient greeters, and I think we want transit greeters, correct?
Oh, I meant to say transit greeters. If I misspoke, I apologize.
So,
yeah, although I care about both.
It's true.
And I was thinking you were thinking of a warm place for him to stay in the evening, possibly. Yep.
No, I doubt that.
Okay. All right. Okay. Oh.
I might make one final comment, Madam Chair, to the representative from unconstitutionally annexed East Portland. I just want to say, welcome aboard.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, I have Tom Barnes.
Madam Chair, Representatives Committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Tom Barnes. I'm going to have to read this because I've never spoke in front of a committee before, so if I don't read it, I will screw it up. I am the Public Safety Committee Chairperson for the Palhurst-Gilbert Neighborhood Association in Southeast Portland. I am also the co-founder of the SRS Bike Patrol, which is the only officially recognized community bike patrol in the city of Portland. I would like to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify and lend a voice of support for House Bill 3047. I would also like to thank Representative Jefferson Smith for informing me of the committee meeting today. So if I embarrass myself, ultimately, it is Representative Smith's fault.
Yeah. We'll remember that.
I use the MAX to commute to work. I also use it to go downtown. I think the MAX is a great resource for the Tri-County area and anyone visiting Portland. Unfortunately, I also think MAX has increasing problems with security, both actual and perceived. When riding the MAX, I have seen how people's behavior change from the way they act when there is no visible security on the MAX train compared to when there is. I don't want to give the impression that the majority of the riders are a problem. They are not. It is a small number of people. I believe House Bill 3047 will go a long way to fix this problem. When people know that there are meter greeter volunteers riding on the MAX with the ability to communicate with the driver and also transit and Portland police, both actual and perceived security will improve. We have seen with the bike patrol that criminals will leave the area if they know they're being watched. I think we'll see the same thing with MAX. Criminals will not stay in the area if they know they are being watched. So on behalf of myself and all the people I have talked to in East Portland about House Bill 3047, I would like to voice my overwhelming support. I would also like to talk about a proposal I have made to TriMet to use volunteers at the East Portland MAC station as meter greeter security. I presented this proposal to Representative Smith via email the Wednesday before his East Portland town meeting. At the time, I had not heard of House Bill 3047, but I know now each program would complement each other. I have also given the proposal to Commander Mike Krebs of the Portland Police East Precinct and also Roseanne Lee of the Office of Neighborhood Involvement Crime Prevention. All three have indicated their strong support for the proposal. The stations for this proposal would be the 122nd, 145th, and or 148th and 162nd MAC stops. The main idea came from the bike patrol. The main points of the proposal are, with the cooperation of TriMet, Portland Police, and ONI, a volunteer citizen patrol will be established to be both public information meter greeter, i.e. help with general information questions for the MAX riders, and eyes and ears at the MAX stops. This would be done with two-person teams at each stop. One team would be at the westbound platforms, and one would be at the eastbound platforms. The best case would be 14 volunteers for each night of the patrol. That would be 12 people at the stops and 2 people at the 122nd parking lot. The patrol could be done with as few as 3 people and scaled back accordingly. We would also need one TriMet security officer to be assigned to the patrols. This officer would travel between the 3 stations by vehicle for quick response. Each team would wear a high visibility jacket or vest, would be identifying them as TriMet volunteers. Each team would be equipped with a two-way radio to stay in contact with TriMet officers and the other teams. Also, each team would have a cell phone for 911 emergency calls. I think the patrols could be performed 2 to 3 times a week to start increasing as more volunteers are signed up and trained by the 3 partner groups, with ONI performing the core citizen patrol training and the Portland Police and TriMet giving advanced training. The patrols would start around 2100 and end with the last MAX has departed the station. The TriMet officer would compile the information for each patrol and make out any reports that would be needed that need to be made. The patrol would not be armed and they are not to be confrontational. We are not the guardian angels. Our only duties would be to inform the public and to be eyes and ears for the police. To help get volunteers to sign up, I would ask that TriMet give annual bus passes to the volunteers that sign up to perform a certain number of patrols. I would also request that TriMet or the City of Portland create a nonprofit 501c to allow the volunteers to take the hours donated to the patrol off on their taxes in the same way the public library volunteers can take their hours off on their taxes. With the economy and the budget in the condition they are in, and the crime increasing at and around the MAX stations, I believe that this would be the only way to improve the safety at the east side stops. This program could be monitored for a set amount of time, and if it shows it has made a marked improvement, it could be expanded. If it has not made a difference, it can be canceled. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Representative Schaffler.
Only to ask one question. Do you live in Representative Smith's district? Or
no, sir, I'm out of his district.
Where, can I ask you, are you in my district? District 48, Southeast Portland?
Yes, I believe I am.
Oh, well, good. I'll meet you. I'll come and say hello to you after the hearing.
Yes. I don't see any other questions. Thank you. And I have Olivia Clark, Shelley Lomax, and Commander Vinnie Jarmer.
You had a uniform on. You're just missing your stripe.
Flight attendant.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. She got the memo.
I thought she was the church lady. No, I did. Just joking.
For the record, Madam Chair, I'm Olivia Clark, representing TriMet, and here with me today is Shelley Lomax, who is the Director of Operations Support at TriMet, and Commander Vince Jarmer, who is the commander of the Transit Police Division. They're here to back me up and answer questions, and if I forget anything, they'll fill in. But I would like to thank the committee, first of all, for your support for public transit. Universally, I appreciate this. I see it. I feel it in the committee hearings, and I really appreciate it. And I also want to express my support to the bill sponsors of this bill. They're all supporters of TriMet. I know that, every one of them. Most of them use the MACs pretty regularly, and I appreciate that. And we work really well together. What I wanted to do today, and I also want to thank Mr. Barnes for coming today. I met Mr. Barnes at an open house that Representative Smith had about a week and a half ago. Today is actually the first time I've really gotten the sense of the program that he wants to create. I know he's been talking to Commander Krebs and others. Having said that, what I'd like to do with your indulgence is three things today, is just to share with you, and I've got two handouts for you, to share with you what we have done on the MACs in the last 14 months really quickly, to talk about whether or not we think it's made a difference, and then lastly, give you some of our thoughts about the use of volunteers to do this kind of an effort. I know since I'm sure many of you heard about the attack November of 07, when Lori Chilcote was violently beaten with a baseball bat by, I think, a 16-year-old at that point. This is a young man who'd been arrested 16 times, 11 times, I believe, in the city of Portland, 5 times in the city of Gresham. He now is an adult, and I believe he's going to be in prison for at least 8 years. But this young man had spent, after all of those arrests, I think only 4 days serving in lockup. It was really, I think, a failure of our system in terms of outreach and dealing with gang prevention and youth crime prevention. But since that attack and since the safety issues have really gotten a spotlight, TriMet has responded swiftly and comprehensively to really change the system. What I want to do is just really quickly run down some of the things that are in the reports that you have. First of all, we made a sweep through all of the MAC stations, looking at them and evaluating them from a crime prevention through environmental design perspective, which is something that didn't even exist when the East Side line was built in 1986. It's the oldest part of the line in the system, and you can tell. I realize that. We have upgraded the lighting on the east side. We have put in closed-circuit televisions. We've changed some of the station's configurations. We've changed the landscaping. We've stepped up the graffiti removal. We're working with the city of Gresham on an access control pilot project. We're working with the city of Gresham to rehabilitate the Rockwood Station, which is in Representative Call's district, with a grant from Connect Oregon and with matching funds from the city of Gresham's Urban Renewal program. On the law enforcement side, we have doubled the number of police that are in the Transit Police Division. We're going to have 58 members of that team, I believe, by July of this year. And 10 of them are assigned specifically, I believe, to the east side. We opened a east side precinct office in the city of Gresham. We also opened one in, I think, Representative Edwards' district with the help of his police chief, Lila Ashenbrenner, in Hillsborough. And we're now opening one at the Clackamas Town Center where the new garage is being built for the Green Line. 70%, one thing that was very interesting to me is to learn that the police that were in the Transit Police Division were not necessarily riding the MACs all the time. Now the expectation is that those officers that are in the Transit Police Division will spend up to 70% of their time on the system. So not only have we increased the number of people that are in the Transit Police Division, we're increasing the time that they're actually on the system. The church ladies, I think, that you were referring to are actually...
Madam Chair, may I interject here? I just want to beg Ms. Clark's forgiveness. I've worked with her for years, and sometimes my sense of humor gets away with me. I hope she can forgive me if in any way, shape, or form I hurt her feelings or offended her. If I didn't know her so well for so long, I would have never said anything like that. And I want to add, Representative Boone started all this.
Chair, it was Representative Smith who started it.
Okay.
He's not here.
He's not here to defend himself. Madam Chair, if I can continue. Yes. Actually, TriMet has contracted with a group called Victory Outreach, which is a spinoff of a church group. These are 8 people who we are actually contracting with. They are paid. They are not volunteers. These are people, in some cases, who are former gang members, former prostitutes. I've met them. They're a really interesting group of people, and they're doing a terrific job undercover on the MAX line. And they're there to really diffuse situations, to do gang prevention. They're fabulous. So we have contract with Victory Outreach in addition to increasing the police and the time that they're on the system. We've also increased private security as well, the WAC and HUD. In addition, we're replacing all the TVMs, the ticket vending machines that have been a real problem for us. They're out there now replacing the old machines. We're also using some of our federal stimulus dollars to paint some of the stations on the east side and to make some pedestrian safety improvements on the east side as well. We've also changed our code. I don't want to get into any detail there. We've secured jail space for violators on the transit system. So all that said, we've done a lot in 14 months to try to increase the safety and security on the system. Has it made a difference? Yes and no. And I would get right to the point that Representative Call made, is that yes, it's made a difference in terms of crime, of reported crime, of the number of tickets that are being issued or citations. But I think that TriMet's done a rotten job of letting the people know in those districts on the east side what we've actually done. Yes, we've done outreach on safety and security in the schools along the light rail. We have a program called See Something, Say Something, which actually Shelley Lomax has used with neighborhood associations. I'll roll this out. There's more than one. And maybe if you've ridden the MAX, you've seen some of these on channel cards on the MAX and on the buses, where we actually go to neighborhood associations like Neighborhood Watch and other organizations like the Elks Club, I think, in Gresham we've been to talk about how to be involved, how to see problems, and what to do when you see those problems. So yes and no. I think that the perception, it takes a long time to change that perception. We've made major investments on the east side, and I think gradually as we continue to reach out, people will gain that sense of security, because that is what our major goal is, not only to have a safe system, but for anybody who wants to ride or thinks about riding, feels comfortable and safe to do that. Lastly, I just want to say, too, that every year TriMet does an attitude and awareness survey to figure out what are the people thinking about TriMet region-wide, both riders and non-riders. And perception-wise, the people who use the MAX on a regular basis feel pretty comfortable. Those of us that ride it regularly know what to expect. We're familiar with it. Those who do not ride don't feel as comfortable. They don't have that experience. Last point on the bill and the use of volunteers. We're very supportive of community involvement. Neighborhood Watch, Solve, we participate in those things. As I said, we train people on the See Something, Say Something. We've been very active in a variety of groups. But when it comes to something like a guardian angel kind of activity, our legal department, as Representative Schaffler, I think his antenna went up on that, start to have real issues with liability issues, background checks, the kinds of training that would be required, the kinds of supervision, management of volunteers. That's a real job. And at this point, like all public agencies, we're in a cutting mode. We're cutting service. We're having furloughs. We're laying off people. While I'm supportive of the idea of a pilot of greeters that are not necessarily empowered to do anything but to say hello and to be eyes and ears, the kind of program that Mr. Barnes is talking about is not something that we're supportive of at this time. That's a very large effort. It takes money to do that. But we appreciate the sense behind the bill. We embrace that ownership of the MAX. We really appreciate it. And with that, I would just open this to any questions.
Okay. Questions? Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. On the folks you were talking about earlier, are they are employees, the folks, they're employees of TriMet?
They're under contract, as I understand.
Okay.
They're
okay.
Not actual employees, so we pay for our contract. We have eight. There are eight of them that ride the MAX.
And then on the volunteer question, the TriMet, and by the way, I'm a huge supporter of TriMet. I love MAX, and you've done a good job of responding to people, not only in the route that's under construction, but clearly the one going into Milwaukee as well. As a matter of fact, I personally have been in contact with your office several times for one person I know in Milwaukee, and you've responded in a timely fashion. I appreciate that. But on the volunteer side,
just Olivia, so I get this clear. Your TriMet is not in favor of that kind of setup at this time. Is that, am I correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Shoffler, I think the kind of program that Mr. Barnes was outlining, which is almost like an explorer, police explorer program, where you have radios and you're in contact and you have special uniforms, not.
Thank you.
Representative Cole.
But the bill before us today isn't that program.
Yeah.
Correct. The bill before us today is trying to engage community volunteers in taking back this resource that is theirs and having them be able to engage with it in a way that is meaningful and kind of changes the public perception around this thing. I mean, I understand firsthand, you know, the amount that you do, the amount the Gresham police that TriMet pays for to keep my line safe. I see the Wackenhut officers on there. I saw them on there Friday night when I was riding home at midnight, you know, and into a pretty dodgy area just outside of East Portland where I live, right? I feel safe on the MAX. I get it. I want everybody to feel that way, and that's the objective behind this. So could you speak a tiny bit to the way in which you see this program or something like it re-engaging the citizens, the communities where the MAX line is going into?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Call. The way I see the bill, and I've had some conversations with Representative Smith about it and his sense of what it might be, a one-day deal or a two-day deal, something like that, where we would actually use the program that we already have to train volunteers to see something, say something, and work it from there. There are a couple of things in the bill that make me a little nervous. The reference to preferring volunteers that have had previous law enforcement experience, I don't think that's where we want to go. That's a little more involved, I think, than we would want to be. But I think providing this kind of information to people who are interested in being more involved is the level at which we're comfortable.
Representative Shoffler and then Edwards.
This just popped into my brain, too, the concept of providing volunteers with a free pass. That could be interpreted as income and used at a future date to file for unemployment insurance benefits. And we went down this road with ski resort volunteers who were provided with a pass, and they were volunteers on these races they have, but they used the value of that pass declared it as income when they went in and applied for unemployment insurance. So I would be remiss if I didn't share that with you right now, too. If in case in the future you're going to provide any passes to any volunteers, I would do it on a day-by-day basis so you could keep a handle on it, keep it below the $50 a quarter rather than get in trouble. And then now you're on the hook for unemployment insurance. So.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you said, Ms. Clark, I appreciate the concept of the bill, but I have concerns about how broadly the bill is written. It's only a handful of lines, but it leaves a lot up to TriMet's discretion, and I would be more comfortable if the bill were more specific about the content and extent of the pilot program. If only to limit the TriMet and the state's liability and the fiscal impact.
That's odd. I'm sitting here thinking that sometimes we kind of like to leave things. Agencies like us to leave things up to them and not ask us to be more specific.
Any agency in mind, Madam Chair?
No. Representative Call.
Yeah, and just on this discussion, I think Representative Smith and I both see this bill as a placeholder, as a starting place for this discussion, but we would definitely like to produce something this session that we could put into effect. So glad to hear that you are willing to work with us in the spirit that we're trying to achieve this goal, and I look forward to doing that, Olivia. I think we'll get something done that's actually effective. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And you guys are just to answer questions, right? You know,
nothing.
Very, very good. Yes, yes. I would recommend you to anyone if they would need to bring some. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3047, and we are adjourned.